Last time on Masters of Modern.
Garrick is just pure beef.
Ralzeric has the dumbest face I've ever seen.
Though not good cards, I think Sarkhans are just generally pretty sweet.
And for number 30, the best not good planeswalker, Nicol Bolas.
Because you'd just play Cruel Ultimatum if you had it.
Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
And welcome back to Masters of Modern. I'm your host, Alex Kessler, here with my co-host, Ben Bateman.
What's up, everybody? We got 30 more planeswalkers to talk about.
This is part two of a two-part series. If you didn't listen to the first one, go back to last week. We counted down all of the bottom half of the top 60 planeswalkers. There's only 61 legal in Modern, so we did 31 last week.
A bunch of, like, largely unplayable, but, like, some kind of sweet ones. Like, the final 10 were pretty sweet.
Yeah, but that's, like, the bottom 10 were, like...
Like, laughably bad.
Yeah, and then like the middle 10 were like, oh, I don't really know where to put these, they're just not good. And then the last 10 are kind of cards that I can one time, someone could convince me that it belongs in their deck.
Having the realization that Obnixilus is like a similar card to Garrick, 7-mana Garrick, but like neither are playable, just makes you realize like how not good 7-mana Garrick actually is.
Yeah. I will say some misses and so those who don't know this, we consulted deck doctors, card scientists, and these are ironclad.
Stephen Hawking.
Everything here is absolutely correct and objectively correct. So
based on years of playtesting.
Years of playtesting and study, and someone melted some cards down, put them in beakers, dripped them into other beakers.
You know what would be really fun?
Put in one of those DNA spinny things that you see in CSI.
You know what would be really fun? Would be we take our list, our full list, and I think we maybe do this after the Innistrad release because we're going to have some sweet new planeswalkers.
Uh-huh.
And we do like a bracket system like Marrow does, and we start posting them on Twitter, like number one.
Like seed them based on this list. That'd be kind of cool.
In fact, it's March Madness right now. We should just do that now. Like it's like we're in the middle of a bracket. Like we should just do that.
I'm down.
All right, we'll talk about that.
I kind of want to wait. Like once all the planeswalkers, we'll start next week because I think we'll have all four of the planeswalkers from the most recent set available.
Yeah, there was another one spoiled this morning, but we won't talk about that.
Werewolves, right? Sweet. Yeah. I think it's just like 2/2, 3 damage. 2/2, 3 damage.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I think it's decent.
Yeah, it seems fine. It's like very hunt mastery.
What was really annoying about it is I went on a rant last week on the episode about how much like the untap ability doesn't actually protect a planeswalker, but
right.
I do actually think the creature gets vigilance and +2/+2 does that.
Right.
Because you're getting value on it. And if you don't have that available, then just make the 2/2 and flip her. So, like, yeah.
The only thing that I find, like, a little bit confusing about flip planeswalkers, like, just... I mean, I did play Garrick Relentless when he was actually able to play.
It's how, like, the loyalty stays the same between flips.
Yeah, just only because, like, what we've been getting with Jace so recently, Rin's Prodigy, is, like, you get to activate the creature side of him and then flip him and then use him again. So he just, like, feels like... That I'm just sort of used to that now. So with planeswalkers, I'm like, oh, I should be able to use this both sides when it flips, but you can't.
No, yeah, you get one of the abilities. Something also to bring up, and it's relevant to that. I do think actually I would put the flip Garrick a little higher than we did.
Yeah.
In hindsight, because the rules have changed are changing. So Abrupt Decay no longer kills the backside.
Right.
And I think that could be one of the many reasons that card doesn't see some play because it used to be just awful against Abrupt Decay, and
it
now
would flip, and then
now it's not as terrible. All right.
Before we get into the 30, we should mention a couple things. The first one is check out our sister podcast, also on RocketJump.com.
Command Zone.
Who just had their 100th episode.
Had
their 100th episode. It was a big deal. They had all kinds of cool guests.
Awesome. I recommend watching the actual video version of it, not listening to the episode, because the video has all this cool stuff. They like do deck tech. They like build decks.
Yeah, and they
on the episode.
And it's very cool. Those guys did a great job with that. Congratulations on reaching 100 episodes. You can find them also on Twitter at CommandCast. At the Command Cast.
Yeah.
We are on Twitter at the MM Cast.
Yeah.
And personally, I'm Ben Bateman Media.
I'm at Kess Wiley.
And last but not least, we have a Patreon account we launched recently. We launched it like three, 4 weeks ago. And the point of the Patreon is that we want to provide more content, video content especially, and we don't have the means or budget to do it without your help. So we decided to ask for a little bit of help from our friends, you guys, and you helped us. We've got like a small pool going of funds to make cool stuff. We released our first bonus episode with Jerry Thompson a couple weeks ago. We have some other stuff in the works, deck doctor stuff. Patreon subscribers are allowed to submit decks for us to review, and then we will deck tech them every couple weeks on the podcast.
Live stream episodes.
Yep, we're gonna be doing I think we're at like 400 something. Once we hit 500 a month, we're gonna start video streaming.
Yep.
That's the next goal. So Anyway, check that out and let us know what you think and tweet at us and all that. Without further ado.
The top 30 planeswalkers of all time in modern.
Yeah.
So for those who don't know, probably Jace the Mind Sculptor would be number one, but it's not legal.
Jace the Mind Sculptor would definitely be number one, yep. And it's not even close.
Someone brought a good point that literally our best and worst planeswalker is Jace, because Jace the Living Guild Pack was number 61, and Jace the Mind Sculptor, who's banned, would be number one if he was unbanned.
I find Jace the Living Guild Pack just baffling. Like, we started the podcast out with this, and we thought we were going to try to cover 61 in one episode, which was foolish on our part. We should have talked a little more about him, I think. It's just kind of insane that they printed a 4-mana Jace, and they were like, Yeah, this card's totally reasonable to play. This is a fine card. And, like, how's the worst planeswalker ever Jace? He's supposed to be the flagship character. You can't make a bad Jace.
Yep.
I mean, they made a bad Jace.
They made a bad Jace.
Actually a bad Jace. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, around the time Living Guild Pact was close to being previewed, somebody came up with a 6-mana fake one, right? Wasn't there, like, a 6-mana?
I don't even remember.
There was
the amount of weird fake planeswalker speculations. There's the blue-black one that just got, like...
Yeah.
Reddited around.
Is it cool?
It had Thoughtseize as one of its abilities, and Thought Scour, I think, was another one. I don't know.
Oh, those sound sweet. But yeah.
I mean, it was sweet, yeah.
I mean, I just remember, like, there was a 6-mana Jace that got spoiled that seemed, like, sort of unexciting around the same time, but it was a fake. And then this one came out, and I was like, God, I hope this is a fake. And it wasn't. Anyway.
All right. Let's get on to 30. Number 30, which is ironic because this is kind of like reverse Nicol Bolas, who was number 31. A Johnny Mentor of Heroes.
Oh, yeah. This is the 5-mana Johnny, the green-white one, right?
Yeah.
This is the one
technically, this is 29. So we're actually starting. We did the 30. Nicol Bolas is 30. This is 29.
So a Johnny Mentor of Heroes.
This is the green-white one.
One green, one white, three colorless. He's like a hybridized, helps out your creatures, but also like provides some card advantage, a Johnny, right?
Yep. No, he gains 100 life as his ultimate. He puts a bunch of counters on a thing, and I think the plus is the draw card in some way.
Yeah, plus one, distribute 3 +1/+1 counters among 1, 2, or 3 target creatures you control. Plus one, look at the top 4 cards of your library. You may reveal an aura card, creature, or planeswalker, and put them into your hand. Put the rest on the bottom of your library, or you can gain 100 life for -8. So he's 4 loyalty on 5 mana, and his plus one gets you to 5. So you're going to play him, and he's going to come down with 5 loyalty and an ability.
Sure. Something I do think... that's cool that they've done with the Johnny is they've kind of moved him into more of a Obi-Wan Kenobi like position. He's now like the wise, older planeswalker that's seen some stuff and is gonna. And I do think Nicol Bolas being the Darth Vader of this universe for this metaphor, I think they're gonna fight the next time Nicol Bolas shows up, and I think a Johnny's gonna die.
That sounds cool. That sounds like something that involves story that we asked you guys last episode if you wanted to hear more about Magic Story. And despite my protesting, it was confirmed immediately.
Flavor Unite.
Immediately. Now, tried to make it 10 votes, but Kessler made it, or I tried to make it 50. He tried to make it 10. We got like 10 in like an hour. So that's what's going to happen.
Yep.
We're going to do a bonus episode at some point.
Probably next month. All right. Number 28.
Yes.
Chandra Flamecaller. This is new Chandra. 6-mana, good Chandra.
Okay, this is the one. So this is like the Chandra that your point was, this card is a win condition in a control deck and nothing else.
Well, it draws you into more cards, which is something a control deck wants, because it nets you plus a card and makes the cards in your hands better if they're not good enough.
Okay.
And it's a threat.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
It does a lot of what Keranos does. Yes, it's a 6-drop. That is a problem. But I do think it kills a person way quicker than Keranos does. It
comes down for 6 loyalty, pluses up, goes to 5... Or comes down for 6 mana with 4 loyalty, pluses up, and goes to 5, and then attacks for 6, and then just gets killed. Like,
by what?
Anything that can kill a planeswalker or deal 5 damage or attack
What things can kill a 6-drop planeswalker?
I mean,
that's
anything...
in play. Abrupt Decay and the new Vindicate, I guess.
Oh, you're talking like legitimately in Modern?
Yeah, legitimately in Modern. What and like 5, like, yes, Reality Smasher is really good against Chandra, but...
Okay, or so they play this and they attack and you don't block and then you attack.
Have another 6 damage coming at them that they didn't
really
block.
And then you like Tarmogoyf, you just like attack
so
with your
Tarmogoyf? So you've done 12 for 6 damage. Tarmogoyf is the one thing.
Yeah, you just like attack
but
with
like,
your Tarmogoyf?
You, why would you play a 6-drop if you had a Tarmogoyf that you needed to kill in front of you?
I mean, I don't know, because you're saying that this card is...
And if you can't kill the Tarmogoyf and they're going to attack this instead, then you got to draw 6 cards and you get to play a card that can then kill the Tarmogoyf.
6 cards?
Or draw the cards equal to your hand size plus 1.
All
so you
right.
get to draw into it an answer if you need to.
I understand that on an intrinsic power level, like, this is powerful. And if you compare it to like some other red planeswalkers that have been not particularly powerful over time, I can see how where your logic is with this.
I don't think this is main deck. And if it is, it's a one of. But I can see this as either a one of main deck or a sideboard card that sees definitely see his play.
You're thinking like, okay, maybe in like the blue, white, red decks or something, this is the top end.
Yeah, or like in the whatever the Kiki decks become now. Got or it. The Splinter Twin decks become.
I don't buy it. Let's move on.
Okay. Number 27. Kiora the Crashing Waves. This is OG Kiora.
This is the good Kiora.
Yeah, this is the... It bubbles a thing.
Air quotes good.
Explores.
When you say bubbles a thing, you mean that it is the one that it like gets to untap? Oh, no.
Target creature can't do or can't receive damage until its next turn. Until your next upkeep.
And it also explores for -2. It comes down on 3 loyalty. Yep. And -2 to draw a card and play an extra land this turn.
Yep.
And then its ultimate is like something to do with an 8/8 Kraken or an octopus or something. Right?
Yeah, it's all, if it ultimates, the thing that's cool about its ultimate is it does it in 2 turns, so it's kind of like Garrick.
Right.
But its ultimate's unbeatable, if you can ultimate with Kiora. It does it in 3 turns, I think.
Yeah, well, it comes down on 2 loyalty, and it's -1 to explore.
Explore.
So you get 2 explorers out of this card if you're undisruptive, which is interesting.
And it protects itself, and it protects you really well, like especially in Modern, where a lot of the mid-range strategies just generally go in on 1 Tarmogoy for 1 threat that's coming at you.
Yeah.
And especially even the tempo strategies, so like... Yes, you have problems against Affinity, but like against Infect, against all those things, you have like 1 threat you need to stop and this bubbles it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fine. I mean, it's...
I think it's a little underpowered. I don't think it's going to be just like the best thing in the format. But
I think if Kiora came down on 3 loyalty instead of 2, maybe it would be too good, but I would like
The difference between those is like it still dies the Lightning Bolt and both ends, so that's kind of one of the reasons I don't hate it.
Yeah, it just means that your ultimate, you're 1 turn closer to the ultimate. I think this card's cool. I'm pretty sure the art for this was on a playmat for an event, and it's very cool art. I like the feel of this card. A green blue planeswalker, the only green blue planeswalker ever that is strictly green blue is Kiora, right?
Yeah.
That's the only strictly green blue one.
She's the only green blue planeswalker.
She's like the official Simic planeswalker.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she's cool.
Yeah. All right. Talking about official people, I guess there's 2 of this. Ashiok the Nightweaver.
Wait, there's 2 Ashioks?
No, but there's a Tezzeret that's blue-black also.
Oh, got it. Yeah, Ashiok. Ashiok's cool.
Yeah, 3 mana. It comes out at 3. It pluses +2. Exile the top 3 cards of your opponent's library, an opponent's library.
Yep.
And then it can minus
put a creature card with converted mana cost X exiled with Ashiok on the battlefield under your control. That creature is a nightmare in addition to other types. And then -10, I exile all cards from all opponents' hands and graveyards. What's cool about this card, there's a couple things going on. First of all, 3 mana Planeswalker comes down, pluses 2, goes to 5 loyalty. So 3 mana Planeswalker goes to 5 loyalty is strong. That's like a tall order just to begin with.
Right.
On top of that, with the Eldrazi stuff they've now printed, and I'm not talking about the cards that are largely good because of the Eldrazi lands, but I'm even just saying like Oblivion Sower, cards that actually use the processor mechanic, let's just say like Wasteland Strangler, the ones that actually care about that sort of thing, this is a sweet card to play along those.
It does something cool there. I'd also say something that needs to be reevaluated is all of the 3 mana Planeswalkers that... exist should be relooked at in the post-Twin world and post-Eldrazi world, because all of these cards are like a lot of the times going to come back down in a time frame that's really early for a Planeswalker to handle, and there's no longer the worry of, oh, I'm just going to die if I didn't Thoughtseize them ahead of time.
Right.
Like, they're all probably better than they used to be.
Yeah, I would agree. And like, also,
you get Tarmogoyf off of this guy.
Another one of the most interesting things about 3-mana Planeswalkers, and just 3-mana cards in Modern in general, is that playing mana creatures, 1-mana mana creatures, is a thing people do. It's not, like, a bad thing to be doing. It's totally fine.
Sure.
So getting, like, an Ashiok or, like, a Domiraid on turn 2 is that's big game. Like, like bird
it's
into...
like you saw the future. Number 25, Domiraid.
Yeah, so they're both, like, unexciting to me. Like, I haven't built around them. But I guess with Twin gone, I like the idea of accelerating out...
Well, Domiraid has one really cool thing it does that I think should excite you.
Obliterator?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sweet.
So it lets you fight with a creature, and Obliterator is a 5/5 that whenever damage is dealt to it, the person who does damage to it has to sack those things. So
you control the ability, but they control the creature that's dealing the damage. So if you just like fight your Obliterator against their 3/3, their 3/3 dies and they sack 3 permanents. It's like pretty nuts.
And you still have a 5/5 beating them down. Yeah, it's really good.
And you can just curve into it.
It's just the mana is really rough.
It's the greatest mana base ever. four black. With a green red planeswalker that has to come down, like.
But yeah, so what Domi, it's red, green, and a colorless. It comes down and it can plus to reveal the top card if it's a creature you get to draw it, and it minuses to fight a creature you control with a creature your opponent controls, and then it ultimates to make all your creatures nuts. They're like haste, flying, hexproof, double strike. I don't know, some crazy amount of
double
keywords.
Strike, trample, hexproof, haste.
Yeah. So really good. If you all like all planeswalkers.
Domri's like particularly interesting because I've tried, this is one of the ones I've actually tried building with before.
Right.
I always look at this card and I'm saying in formats like Modern, in Standard, even a little, I was playing a little Standard when this Kim card came out, and also in Highlander. Like I've tried all of them. And it always just barely misses the cut for me. Like, I can never quite justify
it. I think it's worse in Highlander just because the consistency in that format is really low. But if you're playing in Modern, like the red-green aggro decks or Zoo decks or even Big Zoo, like the Kibler mid-range Naya decks, he's really good in those decks because most of your cards are creatures.
Yeah.
And so, like, you're going to draw a card a lot of the time. And the fact that all your cards are just beefier than your opponent's makes it so his fightability is really strong.
Yeah, I mean, I would be, if you had a creature, like some sort of like creature ability that could reset the top of your library, like Sage of Epitir, that you could repeatedly reuse and bounce or something like that with this card.
Rolling my eyes.
Sage of Epitir is sweet.
I think he's probably really cool with Corsair Crucifix, though.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
They do compete for the 3-drop slot, but or even the 4-drop.
Good thing Sage only costs one.
Everyone rolled their eyes collectively. All right, next one. Number 24, back to the 4-mana, Koth of the Hammer.
So this is like, Koth is like one of those cards that I get labeled for having like so much love for, despite the fact that I've never played Koth in a competitive tournament in my life. I just always talk about it.
There needs to be a very specific deck, but if that deck exists, Koth is really, really good in it.
I totally agree with you.
It has to be mono red mid range.
I mean, it's super powerful. If you've ever like resolved this card or had this card resolved against you, it's like, okay, red 2. This is a card I'll explain because I think a lot of people just forget this exists. Never gets talked about. Red 2 for loyalty 3 plus 1 untap target mountain. It becomes a 4/4 red elemental until end of turn. It's still a land. So it does protect itself. It absolutely protects itself. Or no, until end of turn. So it doesn't. But it's, you can then attack with you. So you play it for 4, you untap a mountain, you attack with that mountain because it's one of the mountains that you played the previous turns.
Sure. Or it ramps and you can use it to spend
-2 add red your mana pool for each mountain you control, which if you're playing all red, it's a free spell.
Yep.
You -2 it to just add 4 to your pool, which is nuts. And then -5, you get an emblem with mountains you control have tap. This land deals 1 damage to target creature or player. It just turns all of your mountains into like, what's that card called?
Pingers. It just ping.
Isn't there a card that does that?
No. There's like a card that pings. There's a ton of them.
Yeah, no, but like a spell, Geist Flame or something?
I don't know.
Maybe.
Anyway, right.
Whatever.
But beyond that, the thing that I really am surprised there hasn't happened, because the mana base in Modern can be so, because of all the dual lands.
Yeah, they can all be
like,
mountains.
I feel like you could do a pretty like red-green base with a blue splash.
Right.
Like teamer deck that's playing him, maybe like the 4/4 for 3 that like gets in there.
And Scapeshift.
No, I don't think he's good in Scapeshift. I think you need, like, I think he's better if you're playing, like, an Ugin that you ramp in the turn after he comes into play that casts an 8-drop.
How is he not good at Scapeshift? If you want tons of mountains in Scapeshift, he wants you to have all mountains in Scapeshift. And he's just a sweet 4-drop that just, like, wins on a different axis.
Sure. The mountains in Scapeshift, like, as a Scapeshift, having played it a lot, like, the mountains aren't actually in the deck.
Right.
You don't want mountains in play. You want every other color. Maybe with a different version of the deck, but like classically, it's like the color. You want to keep those mountains inside your deck and draw all of the blue green lands.
That's fair.
All right, number 23, Tamiyo the Moonsage.
Oh, Tamiyo. This is not a card I like.
Really? I love this card.
It does not surprise me at all. I don't know why.
So it's 2 blue, 3 colorless, and it pluses to tap down a permanent. It ices a permanent, so it doesn't untap during the next turn.
Right.
It minuses, you draw a card for every tapped creature your opponent controls.
Yep.
And its alt is, if a spell that you control would go into your graveyard, you put it back into your hand.
Yeah, I mean, it's another one of those, like, I just win the game alts. I mean, this card is...
Yeah, but this is all about locking your opponent out. This is like the control card dream.
This card is infuriating to play against if they resolve it in the right moment. It's darn... It's very, very hard to beat this card if it's played in the right moment against you.
Sure.
It's super annoying. It's one of those situations where, like, if you're struggling on land, they tap down they tap down one of your lands, slows you down. If you try to alpha, you probably won't kill it. So they'll draw a bunch of cards. Like, it's just very, very difficult. It's well designed. It's a very elegant design for a 5-mana planeswalker.
Sure, I do think 5-mana is the thing that hurts this card in Modern, just blatantly. I'll agree with that.
Yeah. I guess what if it cost 4 and came down on 3 loyalty? It'd be too good if the other abilities were all the same.
Yeah, too good with all those abilities. I think its minus would have to be something less powerful.
Maybe, okay, what if it was drop loyalty and it was minus three to activate the draw ability? So it just,
that I could be a little bit more convinced about.
So
that.
So it suicides itself to draw cards.
So it's like kind of like a Garrick.
Yeah.
Card, triple green Garrick.
Yeah, but
I could be convinced on that.
Yeah.
Something I do want to say about Tamio, she's not showing up in this block. I'm gonna say it right now. Everyone's like, oh, Tamio is gonna be reprinted. No way.
Yeah, you just don't think she's gonna be there, huh?
No, I think she's gonna Ugin it up. Like Ugin was in the last set. He like showed up in Battle for Zendikar. He's in a bunch of cards, but he doesn't actually show up as a planeswalker. I think Tamio is gonna be a similar deal.
Okay.
Yep. All right, moving on. One of my favorite planeswalkers of all time, I think, actually. Right. Number 22, Venser the Sojourner.
Yeah, you love this card.
I love this card.
This is like right at the top of your list for like favorites. I feel like you've played Venser against me more than almost any planeswalker ever.
Maybe.
Venser shows up in like you've played Venser in Standard, you've played Venser in Modern, you play Venser
I've tried to make it work in every format I've ever played.
Yes, and I feel like I've gone against it.
I've never attempted to make it work in Legacy. That would be silly.
Blue white's your favorite color combo? Am I correct there?
No, yeah, yes.
100%. Yeah.
100%. And then it's like followed by Bug.
Yeah, like blinking things. You love blinking things.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. It's so much value. And he like makes your things unblockable, so he's great with Geist that you play on turn three.
The hilarious part is I really like Venser also. Like I'm actually a fan of him.
Yeah.
But the five on Venser is the thing that holds him back.
Yeah. Five mana is a problem. I have played him, and the one nice thing about him is if you're playing Venser, you should probably be playing that 4-drop 1/4 that shuts your opponent's attack step out.
Stonehorn Dignitary.
So you can lock them out of the game with Venser in play if they're only attacking you. So that is something that's like I do think is viable. And there's enough other, like you can play Venser with other Venser, so you can start bouncing their lands out of play. There are cool things you can do with him.
Right.
Which I've done.
Yep.
In Modern. I do think he's a little underrated. I think the five mana is less of a deal with other things because he can either win the turn he comes into play because he makes your creature unblockable or start locking your opponent out of the game, which are two very powerful things. His ultimate is also just an unbeatable ultimate.
Now,
the worst thing that's ever actually happened to me, the one PTQ I ever played Venser in, which was a standard PTQ, I was playing the Stoneheart Dignitary deck.
Right.
Literally got into the ultimate, and it was the same format where Zell's Conscript was in play. In the format, and they Zell's Conscript ulted it on their side.
Amazing.
It was the most depressed. I was like, no. And then they exiled like half of my lands. So yeah, that's Venser. Next on the list, we got a twofer. Nissa Voices Zendikar.
This is the
three mana planeswalker one? That just came out.
The recent one.
Yeah.
I think this card is super sweet, but like I can't figure out why.
Well, it's really good. Have you played with it? Because it's nuts when you play with it. Like I haven't jammed with it in Modern, I'll admit it,
yeah.
In Highlander, which is a more powerful format.
Yeah.
I like it wrecked my opponent every single time.
I do think that like the reason we like both of those formats so much is there are similarities in playstyle. It's just the differences that Modern is
it's high-powered spell format where creature attacking is still a viable option.
Yeah, Modern is super homogenized. It's really really difficult to get outside of like the top 12 or 15 sort of strategies at the higher level.
I don't know if that's true, but what I do want to say about this card is like you can ramp to it on turn two very easily. It's the exact type of deck, like an elf deck that can play that early.
Yep.
And then you make a plant so you can protect it from their whatever two drop they had, which most likely isn't going to get really into the killing this. And then the next turn, you can swing with that plant and the elf after minusing. And you make whatever creature spell you play that turn bigger. Like it starts getting out of hand.
Yeah, no, three mana planeswalkers, as we've said. Three mana is sort of the sweet spot for the balance design. Like,
right.
Jace and Elspeth are the two that, like, at four were just, like, very, very powerful and pushed. Now in the modern era of design...
You mean Liliana, not Elspeth?
No, Elspeth for four mana.
Jace, sure.
They were, like, the original four mana ones that were just, like, really powerful.
Yep.
In this day and age, it's hard to believe that they would print a four mana Planeswalker that made, like, a massive, massive impact. I think it could happen. But three definitely
They're
feels
really
like,
good at balancing four mana planeswalkers.
Exactly. Because they're very powerful.
Well, they made a lot of them.
Yeah. But three mana is like sort of much more unexplored territory as far as like how good it can be. It's like what we were talking about with Ashiok. What if it turns out that Ashiok is like the linchpin card to some new deck in Modern?
Right.
I could see any set being printed that all of a sudden took advantage of exile mechanic, and all of a sudden Ashiok goes to like $80.
Right.
It wouldn't surprise me at all.
Well, this deck is good in green strategies that go wide. All those Zoo decks, like this is a great top end up for that because it gains value continuously. The amount of planeswalkers, even though this is a 0/1 plant, like A, they're kind of 0/1s because as soon as you use her ability, she gets big. They get big. But like, think of how many planeswalkers that as their plus make tokens that have been bad.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I just think the fact that this costs three and is in a set that they're in a color that really wants you to be playing mana creatures is just like you said. Right. That's the trick.
So second half of the twofer, number 20. We're in the top 20. Number 20, Nissa Vastwood Seer. So this is creature Nissa.
So you like Nissa Vastwood Seer more than Nissa Voice of Zendikar?
I am more willing to bet on Nissa Vastwood Seer than Nissa Voice of Zendikar purely from a like experience over life of the format.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you that. So Nissa Vastwood Seer.
And by that, by me, I mean like
yeah.
The scientists that did this study in Iron. This is objectively correct.
So Nissa Vastwood Seer is 1 green, 2 colorless for a 2/2. When it enters the battlefield, you may search your library for a basic forest card, reveal it, put it into your hand. When a land enters the battlefield under your control, if you control 7 or more lands, flip Nissa. She becomes a 3 loyalty planeswalker with +1, reveal the top card of your library. If it's a land, put it onto the battlefield. Otherwise, put it into your hand. So she has essentially +1, draw a card, or get a land into play.
Right.
She has -2, put a legendary 4/4 green elemental creature token with, a legendary 4/4 essentially. And then -7, untap up to 6 target lands, they become 6/6 elementalist creatures. So
I do think the thing with Nissa, this one is, and the thing I think that puts it a little over the other one, is purely Coco.
Yeah.
And Aether Vial. And like the amount of things that, the fact that she's a creature adds X amount of value to her already.
Right. I mean, so I agree with you completely. My thing with this card is, like, it's not unreasonable to assume that there would be a deck in Modern that would want to play, was it Borderland Ranger? Is that what the name of the creature
sure.
is?
Sure, yeah.
You know, 3-mana creature, 2/2 draw card.
I don't think he's good enough, but this is, like, this will always be good on turn 3.
Right.
In that sense, because it's going to get you the land you need, going to come and play block or whatever. But then, late game, kind of like it has a similar feature to Deathrite Shaman, where early game it's good and late game it's better.
It's nuts, yeah.
This is a little bit lean. Like, so Deathrite Shaman is nuts turn 1 and decent turn 5.
Right.
This is nuts turn 6,
I mean,
but
this is
decent
a,
turn 3.
This is a 3-mana creature with the body that replaces itself with a land the turn it comes into play and is an elf. And then late game flips. Like, the incremental value on this card is totally bonkers. The only problem is you have to be playing Basic Forest is the first thing.
Right.
You don't play a lot of them, but you have to be playing Basic Forest. You can't just splash in this, like, into another deck.
Right.
And, you know, it is just a 2/2 for 3 early. So it does sacrifice some power. There's not that many decks in Modern that want that.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Number 19, Narset Transcendent.
So this one's super interesting, right? We talked about this last week on the podcast. We talked about how 4-mana Chandra Flame Speaker, which is the... No. Chandra, the one...
The one that copies spells.
The one that copies a spell. Yeah. The 3-colorless
Flame Caller.
Like that. This is just like the better version in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because it's pluses card advantage. It's less consistent. I'll admit, it's less consistent than pinging your opponent for one. But when it's good, it's infinitely better. And
I mean, look, this comes down with 6 loyalty off the top. So, like, right off the bat, you plus it. It goes to 7. 7 loyalty planeswalker, the turn you cast it for 4-mana, really good. -2, next instant or sorcery you cast this turn, it gains rebound. Like, it's another one of these things where it's like, all right, so you resolve this on turn 4, draw a card, or potentially draw a card.
Right.
The next turn, you activate it and play Time Warp and then rebound Time Warp the next turn on the upkeep of the extra turn you're playing.
Right.
So you get it twice. Like, that seems totally nuts. And then -9, you get an emblem with your opponents can't cast non-creature
like,
spells.
And even spells like any kind of dark card draw spell, even like a Cryptic Command where you like get the like tap your opponent's creatures and draw a card and then the next turn you can draw a card and bounce their land. Like, there's a bunch of things you can do that are really good. I definitely think...
Right. You remember there was a period of time...
Or like just like Lingering Souls in an Esper build, just like copying the first Lingering Souls so it rebounds, you get 2/2/2 tokens, and then you can flashback it afterwards. Like, there's so many different value plays you have.
You probably remember when we were talking a while back before extra turns, Oops All Turns got like to be a thing. I was working on that deck that was like all like I Have Nowhere Boomerang effects and then Cryptic Commands and Snapcasters.
Sure.
It was just trying to essentially like
do
incrementally...
Do that, but from the opposite end.
I wasn't trying to take extra turns. I was trying to prevent my opponent from having lands in play.
Sure.
And this card ended up as like the 4-drop slot that I wanted to play because it just seemed awesome on like 4 when, you know, in theory they have 1 land in play. You play this on turn 4, you try to draw a card with it, and then the next turn, it's like boomerang you with rebound, so I'm going to double boomerang you next turn. You're going to have to get out from under or you're just never going to win the game.
Right.
Yeah, I like this card.
All right. Number 18.
Yep.
Sorin, Lord of Innistrad. So this is the original black-white one. So this is the one that makes the emblem.
Yep.
And the 1/1 vampire lifelink tokens on the ground is a plus.
This is a confusing piece of design that I'm guessing has something to do with the story. That's what I'm assuming is the reason they made 2 4-mana black-white Sorens.
Well, no, he's just the black-white planeswalker, and then that 4-mana seemed to be where they put him at. I do think it's annoying that they're the exact same converted mana cost, and their abilities are kind of similar.
That's what I'm getting at.
Let's not get into the other one because it's still on this list, but the first one... Something that's really cool about this is the like natural make more emblems.
Right.
Like it uses emblems more as a token than a this is my ultimate just status effect that totally. I basically win the game by casting it once. Like it's more like I'll just slowly get more of these emblems. And this was the go-to one in tokens until the most recent one was printed, and that one's just better because of the life swingingness factor of the other one.
Yeah, I mean this also protects itself very well with a 1/1 flyer that gains life.
It doesn't have flying. It's a 1/1 lifelinker.
Oh, got it.
That's okay. That's the issue. The other one is a 2/2 flyer.
Got it. Okay. I mean, I still think this protects itself well.
Sure.
And the fact that it comes down on 3, goes to 4 by making a 1/1. Like,
I think the issue is that the format... Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Just that its ultimate is pretty effective.
Like, yeah. I think the issue is that this is a format where life... Token making is much stronger than the planeswalker is going to be. So it's better when one of these planeswalkers does more with the tokens or more powerful tokens versus this one, which is a better token producer, but a worse doing cool, powerful things with those tokens.
That makes sense.
All right. Next one. This is a 6-drop in the 17. Is it the only 6-drop in the top 17?
Probably.
Is it the only technically 6-drop? There are theoretically higher ones. Elsbeth Sun's Champion.
So this is like the
6-mana Elsbeth.
And this is like the Elsbeth that was like the standard darling. This card
It's wreck standard. Yeah. It was a pillar of the standard format.
Forever. And this was a period of standard I wasn't playing very much, but I still read quite a few articles and I would list like Chapin loved this card. He talked about this card a lot.
Right.
I mean this is
well, it comes down and it does a lot to protect you.
White 4 for 4 loyalty, +1, put 3 1/1 white soldier creature tokens on the battlefield. -3, destroy all creatures with power 4 or greater. -7, you get an emblem of creatures you control, get +2/+2, and have flying. And the reason that is because it pluses to make 3 1/1s. So, like, getting through, unless you have a destroy spell or something with evasion, is going to be very difficult.
Right.
That's the reason the ultimate is not, like... The ultimate's not, like, backbreaking. It's just really good.
Well, no. The ultimate's insane, though, because it's been making 1/1 tokens this whole time. So by the time it alts, you have, like, 13 1/1s that all, like... are ridiculously overpowered now.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, like you're plussing and making tokens, maybe your opponent's like, you know, chumping or like just getting hit, and then you ultimate, and then, you know, maybe, I guess you have to, they wrath the turn before you ultimate now, something like that.
Sure, but from that point on, then you don't ultimate, you make 3 more tokens, and then you keep her around so that those tokens get bigger and bigger.
Right.
Like normally she's, that's like a board stall trump.
Right.
Where you're playing an opponent with a bunch of Lingering Souls and Tarmogoyfs and Rhinos or whatever, and you're holding them off because you're alting or minusing and plussing to keep killing the Rhinos, but then protecting yourself from everything else. But then you need to get over the top, and that's what this is good at. It's a really good sideboard card. This is a sideboard card for sure against like the grindier control matchups because you can draw one of them later, cast it, and just start winning because it's in play.
This has never seen modern play? Or
it has. It's sideboard cards in Junk and Blue-White-Red lists.
Okay, that makes sense.
It's kind of a similar slot to what Keranos is. Like, that's a slot that a lot of these planeswalkers can inhabit, depends on what the metagame looks like. And if, you know, Keranos is really good when Twin is around.
Makes sense.
And you need something to last longer than them while you're stopping what they're doing. This is better in a world where you need either something to kill all the big 4/4, so if Hate Bears or Tarmogoyf decks are really good.
Right.
Or you need something that just block a bunch of ground pounders, so if like aggro is really good, the 1/1s are really good. So it's a metagame dependent choice.
Got it.
All right. This is one of my favorite cards of all time, probably. Number 16, Tezzeret the Seeker.
I love this card. This is a pet card. I love both Tezzerets. I can't wait. Will they print another Tezzeret story yet?
He's not dead.
So they will print
him. Still around. Yeah, for sure.
When
people really like it. My guess is next time we go to Phyrexia or next time we deal with Bolas.
Okay.
Could be a related time period.
Tezzeret's awesome. There's 2 Tezzerets. This is the more expensive of the two. This is blue, and 3 colorless for a 4 loyalty planeswalker. His abilities are as follows. +1, untap up to 2 artifacts you control. -X, search your library for an artifact with converted mana cost X or less, put it directly into play. And then -5, All artifacts you control become 5/5 creatures till end of turn. Is that right?
Yeah.
So,
or creatures equal to their converted mana cost. No, 5/5s. Five, five. Yeah. You're right.
So Tezzereth the Seeker is almost, I'd say, 90% used for ability 2, minus X.
Yeah, yeah, that tutor for something.
Yeah, the fact that it tutors for an artifact in powered formats is nuts, because in powered formats, it can get artifact lands.
Well, no, I mean, in Vintage, the thing he's used for is tutor for Time Vault and then use its plus to win the game forever.
Right, so, okay. that makes sense, but I'm saying, I'm not talking in Vintage. I'm saying,
sure.
In
Legacy, it's
Commander, it's
Commander and Highlander. Highlander, right. There, yeah. You tutor for something that's really powerful and you do well. This one, it's definitely more of a value engine.
Yeah.
And it is weaker than the other one because in Modern, it's less, the things you can get with it are less powerful.
Now, the thing about this card that's sweet, though, and this is like something that people miss.
The toolbox factor, because that's why I love it.
Yeah, the toolbox factor, yeah. Absolutely. And so, I'm working on a deck right now, and I have been working on this deck for a long time, but people forget, first of all, -2 on this gets you Mir Superior, which, granted, if you're only playing one copy of Mir Superior in your deck,
gets you... A more important one is that -2 gets you Spellskite. Relevant.
Yeah, okay, yeah, so yeah. You get a Spellskite, you get a 5/6. If you already have your Superior, this can get you Apocrisite out of your deck as a 4/4.
That's what people are really looking for. They're Apocrysites.
I'm just saying. No. Like,
no, yeah, yeah.
That means you only have to devote 2 slots in your deck.
I think more like it gets you Bridge. It gets you...
Yeah. The point is this can do a lot of things.
Crucible Worlds to start if you're doing a Strip Mine plan. Like, there's really powerful 3-drop artifacts that this can get and then stick around that, yeah. I think is like really relevant.
I think there are some very cool things. And I don't think... Like, if you're trying to build the deck that takes advantage of those undercosted powerful artifacts, like I'm talking about the creatures, which is the reason I've looked at this card so many times, is... You can do this as a 2-of top-end card that's like, okay, I'll just play this as my 5-drop. It'll put a 5/6 directly into play and then live to get another 5/6 the next turn. Like,
sure. I guess my point is that the place that it's most likely and has seen play, right, in Modern is in decks that are doing something where I have, in my main deck, 5 to 10 different artifacts, yeah, that are all really powerful against opponents. And then in my sideboard, I have even more specific ones that this helps me let
I do for. Understand that the point of this card, though, if you're going to use it in a traditional sense, is the way you're talking about it. I'm sure. Saying that there are more interesting and unique things this card can do.
More interesting is debatable.
I think, I'm just telling you, I don't think playing this card, putting a 5/6 into play, and then having 2 loyalty left is unexciting, especially considering the next turn you can attack with it and then plus this thing up to untap it and protect itself. Seems fine to me. Or just get another creature.
Like, right. That seems fine. What doesn't seem fine is having a blue deck that doesn't have great ways to get Mir Superior in the play other than this.
I mean, tons
the point
of
is you have that. But
ever
heard
of a card called Grand Architect?
All right. Speaking of blue cards, number 15. So we're in the bottom 15. This is the last 15. Ready to countdown? All right. Halfway through. Jace, Architect of Thought.
Oh yeah, so this is the card we mentioned earlier that if you ever of every Planeswalker with doubling season, I believe this is the best one.
Right, because you just win by casting it, I think.
Yeah, because if anybody doesn't know the way it works, Jace, Architect of Thought, the ability we're talking about is -8 is his ultimate, which is for each player, search that player's library for a non-land card, exile it, then that player shuffles their library, you may cast those cards without paying their mana cost. So if you resolve doubling season to play this card, comes down on 8 loyalty, -8. Search your library for another copy of Jace and their best threat. Search your library for another copy of Jace and their best threat. Search your library for Jace and another copy of their best threat. That's all of them. So you get...
And then you search your library for... Akroma's Memorial and their best threat. Or another just unbeatable threat of your own, Emrakul, yeah, and their best threat. And then you just...
And you just win.
You just win.
Yeah.
So, no, yeah. I mean, it involves playing a 5-drop followed by a 4-drop, which is a completely different issue.
It's like, it is of a high enough power level that in Modern...
I think if the right card is printed, this could do... The deck is more powerful. Right now, it's not quite there.
The issue is you don't know what you're playing against. And sometimes, like...
Well, that's why you have to have something like an Emrakul and an Akroma's Memorial, because if you get Tarmogoyf after Tarmogoyf after Tarmogoyf after Tarmogoyf, or like Seed Rhino times 4, or like generally you'll be able to find the right amount of cards as long as you have a way to just make them unbeatable.
Right, unless you're like playing against Mono Red or Affinity, or in fact like...
But even Affinity, like getting like 4 of the 2-drop that... 4 Eidolon of Great Revels.
Right.
Sorry, against Burn, getting 4 Eidolon of Revels and then getting Akroma's Memorial. Like, your things are... unbeatable, and they can never cast a spell again.
Or against Affinity, I guess you can just get like Etch Champion, Cranial Plating.
Yeah, like there's like a bunch, or just, yeah, like Cranial Plating works. There's a bunch of stuff you can just get from them. Like, it doesn't, or get
just get 4
Steel Overseer times 4.
Yeah.
And then get Akroma's Memorial. They all have haste, all pump themselves to 4/4s and then swing the next turn for the win.
I think wouldn't you just be better off getting 4 Etch Champions and then just
swing? Etch Champions not good against them. They have artifacts that can block it.
Oh yeah, you're right. That's bad.
Yeah. Master of Aetherium is more exciting because they're all big.
Yeah. Yeah,
right. There's definitely things you can do.
Anyway, this card does other things than this one thing.
Yeah. So the other thing I want to say, this card is at least until the new Jace came out, Jace French Prodigy, I thought this was the most underrated blue planeswalker you could play in the format because its minus is pretty relevant. Like, infect, like, there are so many decks that go wide with tokens that kind of shuts them down.
Yeah.
And it was good against Twin. Like, Twin couldn't beat this card with Deceiver Exarch, which is generally your problem, and you're generally going to be playing red if you're playing this Jace, so it's a really good twin card, or anti-twin card, and its minus is really good. Like, mini factor fiction is really good.
Yeah, people, I mean, this was routinely, for a long time, tossed around as a sideboard card in the Twin Mirror. This was always because it's valuable, and, like, mini factor fiction, like, it gets you cards. I don't know. This card's sweet. Like, this is one of those cards where it's always right on the edge of playable for me in any format that I look at it. I'm always like, maybe. I'm not that excited, but maybe.
Yeah, no, I agree. All right. Number 14. Gideon, Ally of Zendikar.
One of the newer ones.
This is the one that its plus is to become a creature.
Right.
Its zero is to make a 2/2 token. An ally token, and it can ultimate immediately to give an emblem that all creatures get +1/+1.
This card is pretty nuts. Like, as far as power level on a 4-drop planeswalker goes, this card's really, really, really powerful.
Right.
I mean, getting a 2/2 for zero on a 4 loyalty planeswalker right off the bat is already a great place to start. Like, it's already just like it. You're getting, like, essentially 2 power and 4 life for 4 mana. You're getting -4 gives you an emblem, which is one of those rare ones we talked about with Sorin, where you get, like, an emblem the turn it comes down, which is cool.
Right. And it's an emblem that, in vague terms, could be meant to be reused.
Yeah, and also it's one of those cool things where you make the emblem, and then if you have another Gideon in hand, you play the next turn.
Sure. Or I mean, like, the real play is you make a token, or you make a token or plus him, depending on what you want more, the emblem and him sticking around or the token. Then you ultimate, then you have a Gideon, a token, and an ultimate.
Also, +1 to be a 5/5 is super sweet.
Yeah.
That's really good. I mean, this card's really
good. It's 4 mana for a 5/5, indestructible, which is decent.
This card kind of exists in an area of Magic deck building and design that I don't usually mess with. Like, it just doesn't...
Attacking?
It's just not on my radar, usually.
Sure.
Like, I don't know why. There's just something about the abilities, the set of abilities, the way this card plays that is not usually how I like to play Magic.
Yeah, I see this as a top end of a Naya deck, or, like, in those Naya decks we've kind of mentioned, like, big Naya decks that Kibler kind of likes.
Right.
Obviously, it competes with Dami Raid, because you don't want too many planeswalkers with Dami Raid. I do think it's strong. I would be interested to see how it does in the future. It's overtly powerful. It's kind of like the 3-drop white legendary creature, the 3/4.
Right.
That makes tokens when it attacks. Brimaz, where, like, that card is definitely powerful.
Brimaz is nuts.
It just hasn't done any crazy things in the format.
That surprises me that card hasn't done more, considering it has the correct stats, it exists at the right cost.
Right, so this is another card like that, I think, where, like, we haven't seen it do anything yet, and I'd be interested to see what its future is.
Yeah, 3/4 is huge, though.
All right. Number 13, and this is the last one of the original 5 Planeswalkers.
Yeah.
Jace Bellerin.
This card is weirdly, like, where this card exists in the consciousness of memory for people is very strange, because sometimes people talk about this card like it's the most underrated planeswalker of all time. Like, it was extremely underrated when it got printed.
Oh, yeah.
In the beginning, like, no one cared. In the beginning, people were like, oh, this card's kind of weak.
They kind of did that with all of the original 5, and they were correct with Chandra.
Yeah. Garrick was the big one in Standard.
Garrick, Ajani, Jace all were in powerhouse Standard decks.
But just for the record, I remember Garrick was $25 to $40 for a long time. And this was before Mythic. So, like, that was the level of, like, the price of your Chase dual lands in their prime. Like,
sure.
He was the expensive one for the longest time. Jace took a while longer to catch on.
Well, Jace didn't get good until the second printing, which is what hurt him. So Garrick and Ajani both were really good in lore Wimblock.
Right.
Jace got good after M10 was printed, when Mana Leak showed up and Ponder was in the format. Like, that's when it started doing really insane things, even though it did say play it was in a fairy, like, people played them as one ofs in the fairy decks.
Right. Yeah, that's the other thing about it, is, like, it's not like Liliana of the Veil, where it's, you know, your 3-mana planeswalker that's an auto 4 of. Hard to find a deck that wants to play 4 of this card. There's just a lot of redundancy in terms of effects that just, like, do similar things to this.
Sure.
Like, drawing cards in blue is not that hard to figure out.
Right.
Yeah. Though it's a sweet card.
Yeah, you know, it's really good.
Did we even say what it does? Or?
Oh, yeah. So it pluses the each player draw card, but it pluses two. So it's three mana then to five, which is classically really good. And then it minus ones to
draw a card
just for you. The reason it's so good is that the overt we both draw a card makes it so people generally won't try killing him. So they just let him sit and play after you do that. And then you have five turns where you're drawing cards in a control deck, just stopping your opponent from doing anything.
Yeah, you come out way ahead on the exchange because like...
I've never... played Jace Bellerin in modern. Played Jace Bellerin and lost.
Yeah, this is another interesting one where you're just like, I wonder like how smart modern players are like in general that I'm playing against. If I just say like Bird to Paradise into Jace and then just like plused him and then just spent the next like the rest of the game just essentially having a Phyrexian Arena, how fast does he die?
Yeah.
Like.
Well, the thing is, if they attack them, they wasted turns. They wasted one to two because like three mana at five, having to do five on that turn is so hard. Even if that you draw an extra card. That like, it takes them two turns to kill him. And if a planeswalker lasts two turns of attack, it's doing its job already. Also, it's a double fog and it drew you two cards. That's really good.
One of the important things to remember about planeswalkers in general is like you think about, okay, what is the marginal version of the ability that I'm getting here? And it's so divination is your classic sorcery speed three mana spell that draws cards and it draws two when you play it.
Sure.
Whereas this costs three and draws one the turn you play it.
Well, the mediocre is you play this, draw each of you draw a card.
Yeah.
So you net... like 0.5 less than them,
right.
And they abrupt decay it.
Okay, depending on what point in the game it is, though, you might just minus one to draw the card if you want to keep them off cards.
Sure. And if you're playing against green black, you should minus one first because they probably don't have a threat that can kill it anyways.
Also, like, just think about that. Three mana for three loyalty over three turns gets you three cards. If you're not messed with, you're going to get three cards for three mana.
Right.
Seems totally fine.
Yeah.
Really good.
All right, number 12. Finally. Chandra makes it up there. Chandra Pyromancer. This is the first good red planeswalker.
This is Koth,
maybe. So her and Koth are in competition for the first good red planeswalker.
This card is super sweet. This card is the top end 4-drop threat that replaced Bloodbraid or one of the five or six of them in Jund. Yeah.
This is a Jund option. She's best in Jund when you're playing the 3-drop, the green one, 2-4. Crufix.
Corsair
Crufix.
Sure.
Because he lets you get to your deck, so you can Chandra at the right times with the lands on top of your deck to get exactly what you need. It lets you do a lot of deck filtering manipulation, which is a personal thing that I love. But the fact that she's just a card draw engine in red is really good. And the fact that her plus makes it so Tarmogoyfs can get through.
Yeah, I mean, something that's super relevant here is like... people just sometimes look at these cards and they try to like balance the power level in their mind. They're like, okay, so this gets me X for Y or, you know, this cost for this thing. But it's like any one of the planeswalkers, the ones that have the ability that say for zero or plus the draw card, if you play them at the right time in a game and you activate them three times, you'll likely win the game. Like,
sure.
That's just something that is like intrinsic in Magic is like drawing cards is good. Once you've gotten up to like two or three cards ahead of your opponent, if you're not playing just a big stack of crap, you'll probably win the game. And this zeros to draw a card in red. Like, it's nuts.
Yeah. In a color that needs that effect anyways. And it can make things, depending on the matchup. What's interesting is, on some matchups, it makes your things unblockable. And the other one, it actually is going to kill things. Because the matchups where your things aren't going to be unblockable because they have multiple things, they most likely have X ones.
Also, it should be noted that the Jund decks happily play 26, 27 lands because they play so many man lands. So you play this card, you don't play your land, you zero, often hit a land, then play that land for the turn.
Sure.
That's the smartest way to play this card. And because our inclination is often to...
Well, but there's birds, there's Noble Hierarchs, there's Infect creatures, there's Bobs, there's Lingering Souls tokens. Like, the amount of X... Like, to the extent that I think the Exile, the Wingding 1 Exile card... Charm, the Eldrazi Charm, is like a playable card because there are so many different X1s in the format.
You're talking about Warping Whale?
Yeah, Warping Whale.
Wing Knee. Yeah, keep going.
All right. I was wrong. I was wrong about Jace. I apologize. There is one more Lorwyn 10 Planeswalker left.
Okay.
Garrick Wildspeaker.
Oh, yeah. We moved Wildspeaker up. I forgot about that. That's because Garrick Wildspeaker is awesome.
Number 11.
Garrick Wildspeaker, I think, really actually is the most underrated Planeswalker. He of all the ones is the most underrated.
Yeah, should see more play.
Well, I mean, and maybe he will now that we're into a part of the format that
he was even good against twins. That's the thing that like in Jund, you can cast him and then untap your swamp and forest and have Abrupt Decay open.
That's the thing about this card that's so remarkable that people don't realize is that like modern is a format dominated by one and two drops, which means this is a three loyalty planeswalker that if you need a blocker, makes a 3-3 for only minus one. So it's four mana for a 3-3 and two more loyalty on your planeswalker
right.
if you need a blocker. On top of that, it's plus one to untap two target lands, not two target forests, two of any lands.
Right.
Which means with mana bases in Modern, you can pretty much have access to any colors you need. Two mana sounds like a pretty good cost for counter spells, sounds like a pretty good cost for any removal spell. Like, this thing's going to go to four loyalty, have your counter spell open, and then the next turn can overrun if you need. Like,
yeah, no. Card's sweet.
Yeah. Really, really good.
Yeah, yeah.
This card is the one that combos really well with Utopia Sprawl, and I think can do just some totally, totally insane things, unless I'm forgetting. Right? Utopia Sprawl?
Yeah, I mean, untaps lands. All the untapped planeswalkers can do powerful things with Utopia Sprawl.
Yeah,
theoretically. So just Nissa and Garrick. Yeah, yeah. All right. Number 10. This is the top 10, everybody. Woo! Sorin, Solemn Visitor. This is the good Sorin.
So you talk about this, because I'm like, for whatever reason, I'm just not a fan of the Sorin.
So this is like the card that makes the token decks like overtly going to murder the person. And right. it also cuts out their biggest weakness, because that deck plays a lot of Thoughtseizes, and it plays a lot of fetch lands, and it even plays the big one, which is Bitter Blossom.
Oh, sure.
Bitter Blossom and Bob. And so these are cards that definitely hurt your life total. And his plus is backbreaking, because you attack with all these tokens that are now +1/+1 until your next turn. So they like can also be held up the block, and then they all get lifelink.
Right.
Plus it's vampire token, a 2/2 flyer, blocks everything out of affinity, everything out of infect. Like, the things that you get out of it is really good.
It is like, when they say like such and such 2.0, this is truly Sorin 2.0 in the sense that it's the bigger, better, more correctly designed version.
Sure.
Which is, as you said, sort of the reason maybe they just designed it this way, just to make it like, we're just making Sorin. But
we wanted a planeswalker that does this, and the first one didn't do it enough, so here's one that does it enough, kind of deal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like a very, very weird place to come from in design.
I'm very interested to see what the new Sorin looks like.
And is he going to be in this set?
Yeah, he's going to be in this set.
Is he going to be black or white?
I think he's going to be white, black. I think he's going to be a 6-drop.
Can't they give us like a 2-drop?
They did. They did. His name is Jace, and he's too good.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so next one, number 9, Liliana, Heretical Healer.
So this is definitely
creature Liliana.
The top 6 or 7 are kind of polarizing in a lot of ways. You guys might listen to this and be like, "What? Like, how did Liliana, Heretical Healer, make it into the 7 spot?"
No, this is ironclad. Exactly what's true.
Well, we talked about this for a while. So
Liliana. A lot of what the top 10 is cards that actually have seen and do well in tournament play regularly.
Right.
And are like, and a lot of them are key integral pieces of the decks, or something that, you know, is obviously overtly powerful. And maybe that deck isn't tier one, but it's kind of the reason that deck is a tier at all.
Right.
Liliana is a very important piece now of the Coco decks.
Yep.
It's kind of what allowed Coco, between Coco, Cord, and her, you have a like make your own birthing pod situation that's very powerful.
I feel like this should go into my Highlander Jund deck now I'm looking at it.
Yeah, it's really good.
I mean, usually that deck has one creature on the battlefield as the problem, and you don't really want the other creature to die.
Well, but the point is, okay, you have a 2/3 lifelink, which is fine.
Which is fine.
And then if something dies, you get it back that turn.
Yeah, it's
true. You can just bring it back. Like, it makes it kind of does a weird Saffy's Eric's Daughter.
Yeah.
In that case scenario. And like, putting this in Jund doesn't sound ridiculous. Or putting this, more importantly, in Junk, where you have Lingering Souls, like, seems really good, because your Lingering Soul token dies, she flips,
yeah,
and then you discard another Lingering Souls you have in your hand.
And she minus twos to get you back Tarmogoyf?
Yeah, it seems really sweet.
So sweet. Yeah, that seems insanely powerful. Plus, yep. +2 each player discards a card. Like, she takes up to her ultimate so fast.
Yeah.
Yeah, really, really
She's
good.
She's really good.
Yeah, I mean,
what's your ultimate? I just don't even know.
-8... you get an emblem with whenever a creature dies, return to the battlefield under your control at the beginning of the next end step.
So yeah, that's really good.
Gift of Immortality on all your creatures.
Yeah, yeah. And all of their creatures.
Whenever a creature dies.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really powerful for 3. Again, we said it several times on this edition, but 3 mana planeswalkers are something to be like remembered.
All of them.
And
yeah,
noticed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, number 8.
I wonder if the format's just going to get kind of like overrun with like
3 mana planeswalkers.
Probably
I think
not.
That's partly because we're only talking about planeswalkers right now.
Yeah, they all seem so good.
I agree, though. Number 8, Tezzeret, Agent of Bolas.
This is maybe, I have to think here, this is maybe top three favorite Planeswalkers for me. This might be my favorite Planeswalker of all time.
Yep, blue, black. It pluses to look at the top five cards, and you get to put an artifact from that into your hand if you reveal it.
Yep.
And minuses to make any artifact you control a 5/5.
Yep.
And it alts the turn after it comes into play if you plus it to do twice the
number of artifacts. Whatever
amount of artifacts you have, you do damage to your opponent twice that amount, and you gain life for twice that amount.
Yeah, so there's combo wins that you can set up with this deck that just like don't.
The most I play this is in Legacy Affinity, where I would just like the plan was do the Affinity thing, get them to some manageable life total under 14, because you're going to have seven artifacts in play,
right?
And then plus and minus him, and they're just like they lose.
This card does some really cool things. It interacts really favorably with Ink Moth Nexus. It can turn Ink Moth into a 5/5 and it remains a 5/5.
It also interacts really well with Darksteel Citadel. It makes Darksteel Citadel into an indestructible 5/5.
Yep, and it also means that the Spellskites that you're playing in the early game are sweet and they become 5/5s.
Sure.
They can redirect Lightning Bolts.
It can also draw you into that Spellskite. Like, this is a card that, once again, it needs the like one more card in the artifact or the blue black slot for it to be just that much better than it is to be a playable in the format.
We have worked on not wonky, like actually good Tezzeret lists together. I have two or three of them saved in my phone.
I think Tezzeret lists are the middle point between you and me on deck building.
Yeah. We both love Tezzeret. Yeah, I mean, there's you can do some really cool stuff. I mean, and Soul Artifact decks, you can do Torpor Orb decks that just like try to shut down. Though without Twin, it's like less relevant. But there's still a lot of really, really good ETB creatures that Torpor Orb just shuts down. The combination of Spellskite and Torpor Orb as four ofs in your main deck, like, you can just win against 60%.
I do think Torpor Orb is much worse now without Twin.
Yeah, agreed.
It's still good against the Coco decks,
yeah,
and that's a reason to keep considering it.
Yeah, it's good against Snapcaster Mage.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. Number seven.
Yep.
The Ugin the Spirit Dragon.
So this is one where we were like in large disagreement on this. Not because
we weren't. The deck doctors and the card scientists.
I think that Ugin
and
is
the flavor mystics.
Absurdly powerful. Like, it's a 7 loyalty planeswalker for 8 colorless that plus 2 is the Lightning Bolt.
Have you ever played against this card?
No, yeah, definitely.
It's insane.
But okay, how many
and it's insane and it's a staple of Tron decks.
Tron, I get that.
Which is four different decks.
Okay, like just for the record, like if I was to just like search, you go ahead and talk about Ugin really quickly. I'm gonna do something here.
I mean, so what Ugins are is it's plus is the Lightning Bolt a thing,
right?
It's minus is to board wipe for X,
okay,
all colorless thing or colored things, and it's minus big minus is reverse Cruel Ultimatum. You draw seven cards, put X permanents into play, and gain X life.
Right.
The ultimates. Good, but what's really good is just lightning bolting for them forever and board wiping. He's an 8-mana board wipe that in Tron is really a 4-mana board wipe that's really good because it leaves around a planeswalker that's going to bolt them every turn.
So the point that I want to make here is just like if you go and you look at cards that cost 8 mana that are rare or mythic rare in Modern.
It doesn't cost 8 mana. It costs 4 mana.
Okay, in Tron. I understand what
you're
saying.
But it's the only deck that's playing it.
This is like the argument we talk about how good of a card is Splinter Twin versus how good is Splinter Twin in the Splinter Twin deck. And this is why I don't put Splinter Twin like high on my list, and you do.
Yeah, but everyone else on the planet agrees with me.
No. Like, you got it. Eldrazi Conscription,
inherent, for instance. Inherent power level is important. And that's why this isn't number one. And this is why, theoretically, the 7-drop version of him is slightly better. But
it's like I get you. I don't think
a deck exists because of this and another card on this list, and it will see more tournament play than any of the other cards that we've mentioned.
I'm just gonna give a quick shout out to Sunshine Linz.
Are you looking at 8-drop mythics?
I was, and then I just got my 1100th Twitter follower.
Oh, nice!
It's Han Sunshine Linz, who I don't know if you are a Magic follower.
But if you are, shout out.
It doesn't look like it. Nope.
Okay.
So you're not even gonna know. But the rest of the world thanks you from me.
Tweet at him. Tweet at him. Magic facts. What's his Twitter?
It is Sunshine Linz. That is spelled Sunshinelinzz. Han followed me. That is my 1100th follower.
So tweet at him and Ben with magic facts.
Yeah. Tweet at Sunshine Linz and thank him or her. I'm trying to do the research to find out if it's male or female.
All right. Ugin's really good. Yeah. Let's move on. Number six, Gideon Jura. This is the original Gideon, 5-mana Gideon. This is still from that era where they didn't know how to make planeswalkers balanced.
Because this card's super powerful.
Super powerful.
Yeah, really good.
Basically, if you play him and they don't deal with him immediately, they really can't ever kill you.
Right.
Because his plus is so strong.
Yeah, I mean, this is like another card. It's just hilarious. Like, it's so clear the difference in playstyle and deck building style, because there's another card. I would never consider putting this in a deck, but I've also played against this card and gotten wrecked by it so many times. Like, this card's very good.
Right.
This is
another Keranos slot card, and this is really where it goes in. And most decks take this instead of Keranos. Like,
right.
If they don't have blue-red, or blue-red's more of a splash. And before Keranos, this was Keranos. But he's in, like, especially, like, he was good against Twin even back in the day, because, like,
right.
At worst, it bought you a turn so that your 5-dot that you tapped out for didn't kill you. Like, there are just so many powerful things. It kills their creature if they're tapped, so it can come down, kill a creature, and then it's a huge threat.
Right. Yeah, totally agree. Super, super sweet.
All right, number five. We're in the top five. These are the top five Planeswalkers in Modern.
Yep.
So, kind of all time.
Yeah.
These, arguably, in regards to Jace the Mind Sculptor, will probably see more Pro Tour tournament play than Jace the Mind Sculptor ever will.
Yeah, because they will never unban him.
They're legal. All right, number five, Johnny Vengeant.
This is a card. The heyday of this card in Modern was that era where Jund decks started splashing white.
When they were Jund junk decks and they were playing just four color, because it was like right after Bloodbraid Elf got banned.
Yeah, and they were like, playing Lingering Souls and a Johnny Vengeant. It was like GP San Diego, and like all the pros showed up with like four color Jund. Because like Deathrite Shaman was...
It was like before Blood Moon became like a staple of the format.
Because Deathrite had just gotten banned? Is that the deal?
Deathrite just got banned.
Yeah, with Bloodbraid, right?
Bloodbraid was the year before. So both got... No. Deathrite was still around. Bloodbraid Elf was banned.
Was the year before.
Deathrite allowed them to people play the four-color mana base.
And that was when you started showing up as a 4 of in all the decks.
Yeah,
totally. And I just remember like a Johnny Vengeant, and I was like, God, that's so sweet. This card's really good.
Right. If you haven't... So if you don't know what it does, it pluses, taps on a... Or keeps a permanent tapped. A permanent doesn't untap during the next untap step. It
minus twos to Lightning Helix.
Which is do 3 damage and gain 3 life.
Very
and
powerful.
And when it ultimates, it blows up all your opponent's lands.
Yeah.
So what's really powerful is it locks people out of their colors. That's like the best thing to do with it, is make it so they just can't cast their spells until you blow up all their lands.
Yep.
And worst case scenario, it kills a creature and gains you 3 life, buying back the stuff the damage the creature was doing, and you just keep going from there.
And if you can like stabilize and like hit some lands with it while you are ticking up, then you're going to get like multiple Lightning Helixes.
Right. Or it locks down a creature. Like, there's just so many things. This card for a while was the second most powerful Planeswalker.
Yeah.
Or third. It was like Jace, another one that we'll talk about literally next, and then him as the top three Planeswalkers.
Yes, very good.
Speaking of which, Elsbeth Knight Errant, number four.
So we put this at number four, and I guess we put it at number four just strictly because it's inherently powerful, but doesn't really see the fourth most modern play. Like, it doesn't see... This card barely sees modern play, but it's super good. I mean, it's like...
Sure.
The gold standard in a lot of ways for a white Planeswalker.
Right.
And this is in that era when they designed Mind Sculptor, where it's like they just didn't quite know.
This was the second best Planeswalker. This is the first Planeswalker to be over $40.
Yeah, it's white 2 for a 4 loyalty Planeswalker, plus 1, put a white or a 1/1 white soldier creature token on the battlefield, plus 1, target creature gets +3/+3 and gains flying until end of turn, -8, you get an emblem with artifacts, creatures, enchantments, and lands you control have indestructible. So what's interesting about this is not only did it protect itself, but it had 2 pluses.
Right. So no matter what, you're getting towards that ultimate. The ultimate is a little less powerful because of that. Everything is indestructible is good, but it's not like insane. But I've felt very few feelings as glorious as...
Vaulting a...
No. Playing Geist on 3 and jumping him on turn 4 with Elsbeth.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's 6 damage or 9 damage in the air that they have to deal with.
Ugh, yep.
Glorious. Do it. Try it out. It's fun for everyone.
Yeah, no, it's really, really good. I think our friend Claude was playing in the top eight of a PTQ back before the switch to PPTQs. I had like Costa Mesa a few years ago playing Zoo, and he had like 2 of these in the main deck as like his top end.
Yeah, I'm surprised more Zoo decks don't play a 1 of this, because it just is like a trump, and maybe it's a mana based thing where there are too many, not enough lands. But like
jumping Tarmogoyf seems pretty good.
Yeah, it seems really good.
Like attack for 8, attack for 9.
Well, I mean, and the turn you do it, you attack for 8 or 9, you kill them because you've already hit them with your fast Nacatls or whatever.
Exactly.
So yeah, you're definitely good. All right, top three. These are all pillars of the format, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
See a ton of play. Number three, Karn Liberated.
Yeah. So here's the thing.
This is once again the Ugin problem for Ben. He thinks. Oh no. Okay.
I'm behind Karn, and the reason I'm behind Karn is this: the power level of Ugin relative to the power level of Karn certainly higher. Ugin's a more powerful card than Karn, as it should be for one more mana. When you get into that 7-8 range,
right?
However, the fact that you can natural a turn three Karn in the Tron deck, like you're able to. Now, you said you do it a lot of the time. Even with Expedition maps, I still think it's like 30 or 40% of the time you have all three lands and the Karn on turn three. But the fact that you can do that, and it largely is your opponent's ability to win the game, is like probably like 5% if you can get a turn three Karn.
Yeah, unless they're like one of the two decks that, like Infect or Burn or Affinity, or where like a Karn, like they just kill you that after you tap out on turn three.
But or that's, they like leak it or
like
something.
Like Twin was a problem. The same thing is like, it doesn't matter if they cast Karn, I just Twinned you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if not that, then turn three Karn is like just game winner. And it's not to say that turn four Ugin's not. It's just that the deck's not built. The deck is not built to get you turn four Ugin consistently. Otherwise, it would be playing four Ugin. That would be the point. It's built to get you turn three Karn, and Ugin's like the icing on the cake. Sure. Ugin's just like your extra redundancy.
Which I also think that turn four Ugin is not as good as turn three Karn.
Right, exactly. Yeah, turn four is a whole different ballgame.
Right, right. So casting a four drop in general is harder to do than a three drop. I think it's easier to cast a turn four Ugin than it is to cast a turn three Karn. Because you have four turns to find the lands you need. You also get the red-green source to use Sylvan's Crying and Expedition Map. Like, there's more that goes on there.
Totally. That's good for you. And that's why I think Karn is justified in the three slot, but I think Ugin might be pushed a little higher than he should. But sure. That's just my opinion.
But back to Karn. What does Karn do?
Oh, yeah. Karn is 7 mana for a 7 loyalty or 6 loyalty Planeswalker. I'm looking it up right now. I think he's 7 loyalty.
So I'll tell you, it pluses to exile a card in target opponent's hand.
Yeah, it's 7 loyalty, 6 loyalty for 7 mana. Plus 4, he goes to 10 loyalty.
Yep.
Target player exiles a card from his or her hand. Minus 3, exile target permanent. And then minus 14, restart the game, leaving in exile all non-aura permanent cards exiled with Karn liberated. Then put those cards onto the battlefield under your control. I've ultimated Karns before. It's a sweet feeling.
It's sweet. I feel like it's always wrong, though.
To ult a Karn?
Yeah. I feel like you're just going to win. If you can ult Karn, you're going to win.
Yeah,
unless you're like against Twin or someone where they might just like, I won out of left field. You should just keep Karning them and beat them down with like the eventual one coil engine you draw or whatever threat you have.
Totally agree.
It is super sweet. It's definitely sweet to be like, okay, we start the game over, but I have all of your good cards.
Jeez, even after the MM2 reprint, he's still $52.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Number two. This is the newest kid on the block to this top five list.
Already number two.
The only card newer than it. No. Gideon, Ally of Zendikar is the only card printed after. Technically, there's one that's tied. Jace, Fern's Prodigy. Yeah. Two drop Planeswalker.
A card that
a good one.
Probably missed how good it was for 3 months.
No, it was like it was less than a month.
Really?
Yeah.
Before the world caught up?
Yeah.
Well, Standard caught up, but Modern didn't catch up for a little
while. No, Modern caught up really quick.
Really?
Like August is when we had that conversation with Patrick Chapin. That's when we did the Patrick Chapin episode in August, and the set came out in July.
Okay, yeah. And he was already talking about how it's just ridiculously busted.
Yeah.
Just like crazy. Yeah, yeah.
Like we knew real quick.
You know what it is? What always ends up happening is during spoiler season, we get these cards a few weeks before they actually come out. And that's when everybody's first opinions are being...
Sure. We had 3 weeks not knowing how good it was.
Yeah.
And then a week and a half or 2 weeks before we like really realized... Like we had a week or two where we realized, oh, this card's good. And then like another 2 weeks before like, oh,
tournament
no, no.
results.
This is like the best...
card printed in a long
like
time.
Possibly Jace the Mind Sculptor, good, most expensive Planeswalker in Standard consistently since Jace. It's more like expensive than Jace is now.
$80 to $90.
It's more expensive than Jace. You can buy this. It's harder to get your hands on this than it is to get a Jace the Mind Sculptor, which is insane.
Yeah, I mean, I got mine. I have one. I only own one, and I think I bought it like for $40, and I was like, I don't want to pay $40 for this.
All mine are two of mine. I bought two at $70.
Yeah.
And then I got two though at Comic-Con.
Oh, the black ones?
Yeah, those are sweet.
They're like $300.
There might be the most expensive card I own. And they will be.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Unless they ban it because it's just busted.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a looter.
Even
it's
then, because like it'll
one
be
blue,
yeah, yeah.
One colorless, 0/2 wizard, taps to loot, draw and discard. If you have 5 or more cards in your graveyard, flip him. And then he becomes Jace Telepath Unbound, who's a Planeswalker. His backside states, +1, he's at 5 loyalty, so it goes to 6. Up to 1 target creature gets -2/-0 until your next turn. -3, you may give an instant or sorcery card in your graveyard flashback. And then -9...
Kind of flashback, but sure.
You get an emblem... -9, you get an emblem with whenever you cast a spell, target opponent puts the top 5 cards of his or her library into his or her graveyard. So
the moment I realized how nuts this was actually in Cube. It was a multiplayer Cube. 5 of us were playing at the same time. Craig, who, if you listen to the Command Zone, often guests on there, casted it like played it, and it was like literally the week it came out.
Yeah.
Like literally he got it with us at Comic-Con and he put it in his cube and then we played Cube at Comic-Con. It was like this, and that was like, I think that was a week before the set was released even.
Yeah.
Because I, yeah, no, for sure a week. That was the first place. Well, the pre-release was Comic-Con weekend. And we played it and it, like, literally I spent the entire game just having to try and kill it because it was undefeatable. Like he would, I would kill it and then he'd reanimate it somehow because it's Cube. And then he'd just like time walk or do some other insane thing. I'm like, this card is the most insane thing I've ever seen being played.
We should like do something sweet at Comic-Con. Let's put out a menu of things to talk about.
All right.
Yeah.
One day. Tell us what you guys think we should do at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
We'll probably do a meetup. All
right.
Something
cool.
Number one.
This is pretty obvious.
You pretty much know what this is. This is probably seen, I mean, because of the Jace Mind Sculptor ban problem, this has won more or been a more GP and Pro Tour top eights than any other Planeswalker.
Is this card going to get the banhammer eventually? Just because, just by virtue of being really good and they just like to shake things up?
Liliana the Veil.
Black, one. Planeswalker plus one. Comes down on three loyalty.
Plus minus one. Discard. Each player discards a card. Minus two.
Target player sacrifice. Target opponent sacrifices a creature. Is and it opponent or player? Can you make yourself sack?
It is.
I think it's opponent.
I think it's opponent. I'm not sure.
Never had anybody do it to themselves, like, for any ability.
And then minus six?
You get some sort of...
You factor fiction, target opponent's permanence. You separate all the permanents in the two piles. They choose one of them, and they keep that pile.
Target player sacks a creature. You can sack your own creature.
Okay. Yeah. So, she's really good.
Yeah.
I mean, like, just casting her... Once you cast her, if she survives, they can't win. Like, they have to kill it within the next two turns or they lose, is my experience with the card. Like, it's really nuts.
This card needs to go... Oh, my God, it's $111. I, like, miss the prices on these cards sometimes.
Yeah.
This has to go into my Esper Near Death deck in... What's it called?
All right, let's move on from Highlander. So, in Modern, like, this has generally seen play in all of the Jund decks, all the junk decks. Pretty much if you're playing black and you're not being hyper-aggressive, you're playing Liliana the Veil.
It's playing. Eight rack, it's
like,
playing.
It's good at... Like, it's good again. It's one of the reasons I think Geist doesn't see play is because it's just the best... One of the best cards in the format literally is... Great against it. Like
and
it,
not
it's good against control. It's good against aggro decks. It's so good.
I mean, Geist is so overpowered that that's probably one of the reasons that Liliana was designed the way it was designed.
Sure.
I would imagine.
Sure, sure, sure.
It had to be. Like you had to design a standard format where you had the foil at the same mana cost in you know the opposing strategy. Otherwise, you really can't print.
Well, they weren't in the same standard ever together.
Yes, they were, weren't they?
Nope. Innistrad. Jace was banned.
No. Not Jace. Liliana.
Yeah, yeah. I thought Liliana and Jace.
No, Liliana and Geist.
Oh, Geist. Yeah, sure. Because
you
sure,
can't
sure,
print.
Sure.
I mean, Geist is really good, but you definitely need a card like Liliana that's going to be prominent and powerful if you want to print a card like Geist.
Right.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Something I did want to bring up, and I didn't bring it up because I wanted to save it for this. Karn is pretty much just 7-mana Liliana on crack.
Yeah.
Because like literally its three abilities are target player discards.
You get exile a card from your hand.
Kill a thing that they have.
Yeah.
Or... Do some game-breaking ultimate.
Kind
ultimate
of
doesn't matter.
Start the game over with two permanents to one.
Right. And Liliana's like, both of us discard, but really you're going to discard because I'm going to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
I'll kill you. Kill a creature. I kill a creature.
You're saying it in this voice because it's just like the soft version.
Yeah, it's not as strong as Karn.
Right.
And then its minus is like, okay, you're going to like go back six turns and I'm going to be so much more advantaged than you. But like it's discard and removal spell.
Yeah.
At 3 mana, because they also both come down on turn 3.
It's definitely really busted. I mean, it's consistently been, you know, one of the best cards in the format.
If you really want to hear about it, we actually did a whole episode on Liliana
at one point. Yeah.
So I would go to that. That's probably the best thing to hear about it. That's it for the episode. That's the top 61 Planeswalkers in order. Ironclad, this is the
all
order.
All time.
Yeah, of all time.
I guess once we get to 100, maybe we'll revisit the list.
Yeah, probably.
In a couple years.
Yeah.
But
unless they're just like all the Planeswalkers. And
they can't make that many. I mean,
No, they won't. I do think it's possible we're getting six out of this block.
I just want more 1 and 2 mana Planeswalkers. That's all I want. I don't even care if they're underpowered.
We eventually need to do our 1 mana.
Yeah.
So that's not this episode.
Kithion exists, by the way.
Yeah, Kithion exists. We got some cool J submissions, actually, after we talked about that.
Yeah.
If you guys want to send us your Planeswalker, 1 mana Planeswalker submissions for each color, we'd love to look at them.
The hilarious thing is that any 1 mana Planeswalker they ever print would be significantly less powerful than Deathrite Shaman. It's just like so funny.
They could print. Yeah, it will.
There's no way. That's the other band, Planeswalker,
sure,
other than Mind Sculptor.
I actually have a good idea for a green one, but we'll talk about that later. All right.
Okay.
So this has been great. I am Alex Kessler. You can find me on Twitter at Kess Wiley.
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ben Bateman Media. Thank you for my 1,100th follower. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Check out the MM Cast on Twitter as well. Make sure to check out our Patreon, Facebook. I am Twitch streaming, and that's also right now where our Twitch goes when we live stream. So that's twitch.com/Xander574 with an X.
Yep.
And your movie talk thing.
Oh, yeah. Action Movie Anatomy. If you love action movies, if you love hearing, like, who's the sweeter hero and, like, what's the fist pump moment and, you know, when's your F yeah moment, stuff like that, that's, we do all that fun stuff on the show. And we've covered 50 plus movies now. So if you just go to youtube.com/thepopcorntalknetwork, the show is called Action Movie Anatomy. If you have any trouble finding it, just YouTube search Action Movie Anatomy. You'll see we've got, like, 50 plus episodes now.
So this is going to be a little dated. Because, and this is a little bonus thing about the new Planeswalkers, since we're talking about Planeswalkers, I'm going to guess where they're placing. I have no idea where Soren is, and I mentioned him, and we're probably going to know what it is by the time this episode gets released.
Sure.
I do think the werewolf one is probably in the top. The werewolf and Nahiri are both in the top 30.
Okay.
I think they're closer to top 20 even.
Sounds good.
Yeah, cool. All right. Thanks, guys. Talk to you guys next week.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to the mmcast@rocketjump.com. See you later, alligator.
Yeah.
Last time on Masters of Modern.
Wait, I thought we were going to do music intro.
I'm going to do that after.
All right, start up.
Okay.